If you use the internet on a daily basis, and chances are you do, you probably don't put much thought into cybersecurity. You know, your network connections, the pages you visit, the files you download. You should be thinking about these all the time. Welcome to And Security for All. Your host is Kim Hakem. We're here to help you understand, in general terms, how and why your cybersecurity should be kept in check. Now, here is Kim Hakem.
Hello, everyone. Happy Friday. I hope you're all enjoying your day wherever you are. I'm Kim Hakem, your host. Welcome to another episode of And Security for All. I happen to be in Utah right now where I'm looking outside and watching some skiers. We finally got a ton of snow up here, something people in Utah have been waiting for. This is a strange year that we haven't had that much snow, but it's a very beautiful day here. I hope wherever you are, I hope it's a fabulous day. We are, as most of you know, I am the CEO of FutureCon Events. We put on cybersecurity conferences all over North America, and FutureCon, we have a very busy and exciting next 3 weeks. We are actually next week going to have our cybersecurity event in my hometown, St. Louis. Very excited for that event. That is where I kind of got everything started. So it's always fun to see friends that I've known for a long time, a couple of decades, I hate to say. But yeah, it's a great city and looking forward to seeing everyone in St. Louis. Then we're heading out to the West Coast for our rescheduled Los Angeles event. Our heart goes out to all the victims of the fires that are still recovering from the aftermath of everything that happened out there. Hopefully we can just bring a tiny bit of light to some of the attendees day who might be attending our event next week. We very much, again, our hearts and prayers go out to everyone out there and everything that you all are still dealing with. After LA, the next week we head to the East Coast and we're going to the great city of Philadelphia. We love our Philadelphia event as well. A very, very busy month where we're hitting each side of the United States. We're hitting the West Coast, East Coast, and the Central. So excited. I will be at all three of them. So excited to see it, all our friends at all of these events. Today's guest, I have Richard Byrd. He's the Chief Security Officer at Singular AI, and he is the author of Famous with 12 People. Today, we're going to talk about navigating a cybersecurity career, which is a pretty big topic to talk about. Welcome to the show, Richard.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here as well. We're excited to have Singular AI join our events. And before we get into Singular AI and what you all are doing, let's talk about you for a little bit and like your book and how you got to be a CISO and tell us a little bit about your journey.
Oh, well, everything in my career has been by accident. So that's probably the best place to start. I've been in technology. Actually, last year was my 30th year in technology of some kind. And I started out my career as a tech program manager. And I always remind people there have been times in history where there have been certain job roles that have been hot. And if you think about the, you know, early to middle 90s, project and program management was one of them. But I actually had come out of the Army and become a construction project manager. And I always laugh because I learned how to do project management for a little company called Walmart. And we used to project manage the construction of stores with Gantt charts printed out and pasted to giant 4x8 sheets of plywood. And I remember the very first program that I ran, a mainframe migration for a payment processing company. And the developers came in and engineers came in and said, sorry, we're going to be 6 months late. And I kind of flipped out with my young self and said, we don't miss a grand opening date. And my mentor and manager pulled me aside and he goes, this is technology. He said, we miss dates all the time. So I learned early on how technology really works when we're developing and when we're, you know, putting things into production. But I went through my career into banking unexpectedly and ended up spending a long time in banking, a dozen years at JP Morgan Chase. My first phase was IT operations. So I actually moved through technology in the first phase of my career into a CIO role. Once I realized that being a CIO wasn't all that I thought it was going to be, I took up an invitation to return to JP Morgan Chase in the early days of centralized information security. And I have to say information security because it wasn't as cool now as it was back then. We had a dull name and now it's cybersecurity. And the only job left that nobody else wanted was identity. And unexpectedly, I was able to turn that role in identity into becoming the global head of identity for all of the consumer businesses. And then that pushed me into CISO roles. So I spent 20 plus years on the enterprise side in executive technology management roles. And then I decided that I was really worn out in the corporate world, thought I was going to consult for a year or so. And then I started talking with startups. And all of a sudden, next thing I know, I'm being recruited. And I have to give a shout out, a big shout out of thanks to Andre Durand at Ping Identity. Andre hired me on the pre-IPO team. And that set off this last 7 or 8 years of being on the solution side, being in startups, now joining Singular. And actually, if I wrap that around to the book, becoming a known personality in cybersecurity, A, is very weird. But I realized that there are a lot of people, particularly in security, but really in every domain, every industry, every vertical, that really have a lot of important things to say, but don't have the, you know, any knowledge on how to get started. So when I wrote the book, it actually was my journey the last several years of personal branding, tying a personal brand to a company brand, and really a field manual for how to extend your voice in the market. Most personal branding books are about how to leverage social media. And I cover everything from speaking and abstract submission. How do you get into conferences? How do you get, you know, engaged with PR? And my real motivation for writing that book was to create knowledge for folks who really have important things to say in their respective industries, but just don't know the way to get to those platforms, to those podiums, to those, you know, webcasts and podcasts and webinars. And that's how it's kind of all come together. It's been a wild journey. I feel like Benjamin Button living life in reverse, where I'm every day now, you know, after 30 years in technology, every day I'm learning something new about venture capital and private equity and startups and investors and all the different things that kind of come with being in that startup space. So it's been fun.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, I can definitely relate to, you know, some of your journey just because my journey have been kind of around for almost as long as you, a few years shy, but, you know, just, you know, things do accidentally happen. It's that old adage, you know, hard work and, you know, hard work, it, you know, just matches opportunity sometimes. And just even this podcast was just an accidental thing that I fell into that ended up, you know, being an outlet to meet great people like you that are on the show all the time that I don't have time when I'm running my events to stop and, you know, spend an hour with them. So it's always exciting hearing other people's journey as well. So, and then Ping Identity, it's funny though, they will be in St. Louis as well. So, because you guys are going to be out at our St. Louis event and Ping Identity. What other startups did you? There's so many of them. You know, I've seen so many over the years that I don't even remember, like, who's a startup anymore because so many just get bought out. And, you know, I mean, we've seen a lot of very wealthy people that are like us that have become super wealthy because of the companies they've started. So...
Yeah. I started at Ping Identity and that was a fantastic education, 3 years. And really what was helpful to me, this might be a good nugget for people that are looking to make that transition out of corporate roles. And I actually mentor tons of C-levels who have that desire. But the move for me was into a late stage startup with Ping that was actually under private equity ownership with Vista Equity. And the reason why that was valuable to me is because if you're an old corporate person, companies like Vista or Thoma Bravo or, you know, everybody in that PE, large PE space, it's familiar. There are checklists and best practices, and you're expected to, you know, be audited and change your patterns of work and methods based upon their structure. So it was a great way to start. And it was also an awful way to start because then Ping went public. And so if your first startup is a company that goes public, you become very spoiled. You know, to be able to stand on the New York Stock Exchange floor, to have written a 2 pages of the S-1 myself and not have it edited, you know, extensively by lawyers, really one of the coolest things in my career. And then I found that I was running out of kind of new things to say in the identity space. Having the identity background that I have, that's where a very large part of my reputation is. And I thought, well, maybe it's time for me to try something new. And this is going to sound a little odd, but I won't name the second startup. I was with them for a year. And the reason is that you find out that startups are very emotional enterprises. You work very hard. There's a lot of personal attachment to messages and that kind of thing. And this particular startup didn't work out the way that I ever expected. Matter of fact, it was unexpectedly bad. The people that I worked with were great, but the mechanics of taking on the market and being successful just weren't really kind of in the wheelhouse for that particular company. And that opened up an opportunity where I had started, which is part of the progression of the career on this side of the equation. I had started doing some advising, and advising opened up a very unexpected opportunity for me to join Traceable AI. And it was in the API security space. And it, probably a second nugget of help around, you know, career growth. I remember talking to the founders, Jyoti Bansal and Sanjay Nagaraj. And I was like, look, guys, you don't need me. Like API security, I'm an identity guy. Like, why would you think I would fit? And then they started to educate me on API and APIs. And I learned a ton about the intersect of identity with APIs. And then that became a leaping off platform for really deep diving, going down the rabbit hole on API security for a couple of years. Traceable then was just recently merged into Jyoti Bansal's other company, Harness, and that's a CI/CD platform. And then that created another transition where I'm not necessarily a good fit on the DevOps side of the equation. And the next thing I know, I received a phone call from Shiv Agarwal at Singular, and he said, hey, we want you to join the team. And I think this is one of the fun things about building that personal brand. It creates pathways where job opportunities will come your direction without you having to submit resumes, without you having to post to job boards. And I'm sensitive to the fact that it's a very tough time, you know, for a lot of people in technology as layoffs are happening, the federal government layoffs are coming on en masse, and people are applying, you know, to thousands of jobs. But by building a personal brand, I've been in a situation where I haven't applied for a job in over a decade, just because it's this self-sustaining flywheel of reputation and credibility that you create by being, you know, something that an asset that the companies want. And so it's been a nice progression to go through startups. But I, like I said, Benjamin Button, I went from pre-IPO to IPO. And joined a pre-revenue stealth company that just launched about 3 weeks ago. And the mechanics of each one of those stages and phases is so totally different. That's where that learning continues. It's a lot of fun.
Well, that's awesome. Congratulations on the, you know, everything that you've done in your career. It is, you know, interesting. And talking about a career in cybersecurity, you know, it's, we talk about like these massive layoffs that are happening in our industry right now. But then on the other hand, you still have that, you know, that need, everyone talking about there's not enough people for the jobs that are out there. It just is such a gray area that's just, you don't even understand it. I don't understand it. Maybe you understand it, but I don't understand. You know, I am seeing so many CISOs that I have a huge connection with CISOs all over, you know, the country. And I'm seeing so many of them, you know, probably for protection for themselves, stepping down from roles and trying to get over either being a VCISO or, you know, just trying to get over on this side of the things where you are. So where do you think we're going? I mean, like, that's, I know that's a big question, but it's just, we're seeing really big changes in the industry right now.
Well, one of the really fun things about what I get to do is just the network that I have. And I'm really fortunate that some of those people in my network that I would consider mentors, I've had for a long time. And one in particular is Jim Routh. And Jim and I were having a conversation a few weeks ago. And I said, look, I don't have anything on my agenda for, you know, this month's conversation. I said, I just have a question. And I said, I'm talking to so many of my CISO friends in the enterprise, and they're talking about, you know, layoffs. They're talking about reduction in budgets. They're talking about, I have to try and find some way to offset costs that I've been spending in this area to be able to afford solutions in another space. And I said, Jim, what's going on? And he said, hey, do you remember when we were CIOs? He said, back in the, you know, late aughts. And he said, what was it like? And I said, oh, man, that was hard. As we were just getting hammered for using too much storage, and we had too many redundant applications, and we had too many, you know, of this and too many of that. And we were given, you know, really strict mandates to deliver more value with less. And that drove a ton of consolidation and convergence across, you know, a very diverse technology landscape. And it forced us to refactor a lot of applications. Of course, cloud, you know, came on, and that began to help in that effort. But it was really hard to be a CIO or a CTO in the late aughts. And he said, that's exactly what's happening to CISOs now. All right, CISOs are being driven to be more business leaders than to be technology leaders. And as part of being a business leader is running efficient and cost-effective organizations. There are still tons of all the different organizations that I'm involved with, kind of outside of the workspace, you know, the CISO Society and NIST and ISO and, these different organizations, you know, the questions keep coming up, like, how do I show return on investment? How do I show business value as a security practitioner or CISO against what I want to purchase? And to have that still be a question 20 or 25 years in is problematic, right? Because now CISOs are being forced to show things like cost savings and efficiency improvements in an area that wasn't really built around those metrics. So to kind of tie that off, I would say that over the next probably 24 months, I think it's going to be a rough patch. I think that we're going to see a lot of restructuring that's going on relative to budgets and cost effectiveness. And we're going to see a lot of folks that are going to be victims of that churn as CISOs are being both elevated in their responsibilities on the business side, but also, you know, having a laundry list of demands that are going to be very difficult for them to meet without, you know, again, cost savings, cost cutting. You know, so I think that's going to be the tone for the next couple of years. And I know that's very hard. Like, if you've lived through these cycles, and I think I'm on my sixth or seventh economic downturn, nobody wants to go through them. They're no fun. But the upside is that it's always followed by, you know, a period of growth and a period of opportunity. And I think that that's what we're going to see.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was just, we had an event out in Detroit, I think it was last week. I can't keep up with them, but I was talking with some, they are CISOs, but they were with Fortune 100 companies, and we were having this conversation, you know, about them, you know, being let go from their position. And I think it was more because of budget cuts. And we're seeing like these large companies that aren't even hiring CISOs. They're just elevating their internal teams to the CISO role. So I do feel bad because I feel like for so many years, the CISO is like the cream of the crop, you know, the star of Hollywood, you know, and now all of a sudden we're seeing some shifts. And not only just with budget costs, with legal things that we've seen in the industry as well. So Sorry about my dog is in the background being a very bad dog. So pardon the background noise. But
I thought it was mine.
Well, hopefully it's yours and not mine, but I'm pretty certain it's mine. So anyway, so how do you think, you know, for somebody that's just getting started in the do you think this is a good time to get started in the industry? And we talk about this all the time. What do you think somebody that just graduated from college with the cybersecurity degree, you know, they're having hard times finding jobs. What is your advice on how to tap into the industry?
Well, I mean, obviously, first is don't stop, don't quit, right? It's a coming through economic, you know, cycles like these, it can be a fight to get your foothold in place. And, you know, I kind of reflect back on 07, 08, 09, you know, the mortgage crisis. And I remember so many, I have a mentee of mine, you know, that was, you know, had an engineering degree and was working in a call center. And I know that's very, very, you know, frustrating to hear. But now Tony is one of the, you know, stellar leaders in third-party risk management. You know, so this is the time where you counsel and mentor young people, especially, that this too shall pass, right? There will be opportunity, and you're going to have to work hard to try and get that foot in the door. I think that, you know, one of the things that was a fascinating observation, you know, that I got from Traceable, from the founder, was he said, the best companies are built in the hardest times. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Now, it's a little harder in the enterprise space because, you know, enterprise organizations have a lot of institutionalized corporate politics. They have a lot of institutionalized budgets. There's turf battles, right? And those dynamics can make it, you know, difficult for companies to, you know, produce a better company during downtimes, which is why we see kind of the, you know, the immediate knee-jerk reaction to be, you know, cut costs. Right. And the reason is because, and I remember this, like I had somebody talk to me years ago when I was in corporate that was in the startup world. And they said, well, what's the big difference? I said, well, every time you sell more, you get more money, right? You either get more compensation or you get more funding. And I said, every time I exceeded expectations in my job, and I said, I was told, that's great. Do the same thing or better next year with 10% less money. That's the enterprise reality, right? So when we look at the way that companies get better in downtimes, they are very different between the solution side and the enterprise side, the mechanics of it. But there's still truth in that reality that companies get leaner, they get faster, they get more efficient, they get smarter. That creates opportunities. But if you're in that entry point trying to get in, you're just going to have to recognize that you're going to have to knock on a lot of doors, and you're going to have to not give up. And I know how difficult that is. I, you know, even though I've not had to do a job posting, you know, in 10 years, I know what it was like to go try and find that next job. I know what it was like to put out 347, you know, applications and not get any responses. And it's hard. You just have to, you know, build resilience, and you have to build that internal strength to get through this, because it's not going to stay this way forever.
It's definitely not going to stay this way. I think, you know, it's just cyclical. You know, we're on a roller coaster, and I've seen it several times. Cybersecurity is not going away. Breaches are getting worse. AI is here. We've got so many issues that we have to deal with. So how do we get ahead of that with the downfall of just, you know, the community right now?
Well, look, I guess I will, you know, spend the cynical and skeptical part of my personality in the conversation, something I'm pretty well known for. I think it's unconscionable that enterprises are cutting security, especially given the reality that the track record of enterprise security is just so bad. And if you're in an enterprise role, I'm sorry, I don't mean to insult you. It's just math, right? We're moving into trillions of dollars of losses. The hockey stick curve of cyber losses has just been escalating, right? And I frankly, you know, how we get through this, I hope, is that companies are refocusing on where they're really getting crushed, which is in foundational security. I hate to say basics, right? Because I think basics is really, really trite when we're talking about security. But foundational security is data security, identity security, you know, next gen, you know, web application security. And we're bad collectively at the basics. The best example I can give you is ransomware. Ransomware is not a sophisticated attack. Ransomware is typically a social engineering attack that allows entry to a poorly managed identity control plane. And then that particular actor is just simply escalating their own privileges by wrapping up all of these different, you know, entitlements and grants that should never have been allowed to continue to float around inside of your digital estate, and then shuts everything down. It's a foundational problem when you get beat by ransomware. And yet we talk about it like it's this, you know, thermonuclear engine powered attack vector, and it really isn't. So, you know, it doesn't just need to be ransomware. Obviously, you know, DDoS and everything else that we see, we've seen these attacks for years. And yet I talk to, you know, not security professionals. I talk to people that, you know, are either the manager for security professionals or CEOs, and they're off worried about the next, you know, hypothetical attack vector. And yet they keep getting beat on these foundational pieces. So I really hope that when we are going through this cycle, we see a return to good practices, good focus, good stewardship in getting the foundational security components right. Now, I said that, and I think I said that during the last downturn and the downturn before that. I don't hold out a huge degree of hope for that. But I think there's enough of us in the industry that are just saying, like, look, how many times are you going to get beat on the simple stuff before you realize I probably should fix the simple stuff? And you don't need to, you know, stack in tons of new people in your organization to go fix those simple stuff. Stop giving people access to stuff that they shouldn't have access to. There's rule number one.
Well, fortunately for us at FutureCon, I mean, we still are getting packed events with cybersecurity practitioners. Their bosses are letting them come out. Education is super important. We run all of our events in a hybrid mode, so you can still, you know, get your certifications through our events. So, you know, we have packed events. So it's, you know, there's a lot of practitioners out there and so many more that, you know, we would like to see. So how do you now, and we see a lot of new companies that come in, you know, because a lot of people do use our platform to get their name out there, like Singular AI. How competitive is it to start a new company, you know, to launch a new company? And what are you guys doing at Singular AI? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, I'll start with what Singular AI is doing, which is so fascinating to me. The focus for, you know, Singular AI is completely around AI governance and security at the AI usage layer. You know, so there's a ton of companies right now that sprang up over the last 24 to 36 months that are focusing on, you know, LLM security, model poisoning, prompt injection, you know, everything on the really more the development side of the equation. The reality is that those developers are also going out and reaching out for, you know, any number of tools from Hugging Face, you know, ML and LLM models there. They're, you know, bringing them into your organization without much in the way of oversight relative to observation. But then your employees are using, you know, everything that makes their job easier without you knowing about it. Like, I like to, you know, make an equivalent here that if we go back to the early days of web applications, I was a CISO at the time, and I remember company came in and said, how many web applications do you think you're exposed to? And I said, oh, like 30. And they did an assessment and it was like 320. And I didn't know, right? Because I didn't have control over all of these externally provided assets. And so Singular is really focused on recognizing every single AI agent, every single AI service, every single AI feature that's embedded within all the extant contracts that you already have with all your solution providers, Salesforce, Figma, Canva. Everybody is building AI componentry into their solutions. And the reality is that even those big companies probably really aren't doing a good job of disclosing the introduction of an AI component like they would with a software code change. That typically under terms and conditions of the contract, they're obligated to inform their customers about. They're just saying, hey, we've got this cool new feature, which raises a lot of concerns because obviously in most companies, all of these assets are external to you. So it's like a third-party risk management program on risk problem on steroids, where changes are being done, AI agents are being retrained. And when you retrain an AI agent, it may potentially go look for new information that you never really authorized it for in your company. So Singular focuses on all of those capabilities. And what I really love about it is that when I think about convergence, I don't think about convergence as it relates to security solutions, you know, being bought up and merged with each other. I think about convergence across the entire enterprise. So I don't think that it's possible to engage in good governance that's driven by good policy creation, that's driven by risk appetites and risk focus of a particular company in a particular industry, and keep that function separate from security or separate from finance or separate from legal. I think that there's a tremendous amount of commonality in contextualized data that's valuable to all of those organizations. And that's really what I find fascinating about Singular. That's what they've built. They've built an extensive governance platform that really covers the entire infinity loop of discovery and then vetting and then onboarding and then remediation of any control defects and then authorization to operate and then a continuous lifecycle management. And I really think that that's where a lot of technology solutions are going to go in the future. But to be on one that's so early on that is really, really cool. Now, to your question about how hard is it to do startups? It's a little weird right now. I think great ideas will always find funding. I think when you see a certain amount of companies that have come into the space, then in this economy, I think you see a lot of venture capital firms in particular who will pull their money off of the table because there's where there was maybe 3 years ago, room for a dozen players to do the fight club and battle to win, to be the, you know, the remaining two or three. There's not that kind of room now. So typically where I'm seeing a lot of funding going in all different kinds of AI, AI ops, AI security, you know, all the different kind of componentry, you're seeing really only about five or six viable entrants come into those. And the funding market, the investing market, is pulling the dollars back to the sideline to see what the next trend or theme they're going to invest in. So it's narrower. So you have to be faster and earlier, and that's tricky because that means you're pushing into nascent parts of a particular, you know, solution area where a lot of the big guys that, you know, have enormous contracts in the security side are just simply going to try and invalidate the value proposition by saying, oh yeah, we do that too. And the reality is they don't do that too, because if they did, A, they would have already built it. And B, they would be solving that problem in the customer space. And investors and founders are not stupid. They don't jump into, you know, all of the work that it takes to do a startup simply because they think there's an opportunity in a space that's already fixed. they go after spaces where the problems are extant and the problems are resident, and they're not being resolved by the big players. And so I would say, if there was any other thing that I would add to this, I would say that, you know, the big dogs in security solutions really, and I'm going to look in the camera and say this, you all really do a big disservice to the security practitioner community in particular by stifling innovation. And I'd love to say that you guys can innovate as fast as the startups do. The truth is that y'all are public companies, and you can't go park $25 million and go tell your investors that you're going to spend 12 months developing, you know, a solution to get to parity with these startups, and the investment community being happy with that. They're going to ding your stock. You know, so I think that we really need to find a better ecosystem where large security solution companies are actually incentivized and helping startups. Maybe they acquire them at some point in the future. And there are some really great, you know, funds. Okta's got a great fund. Dell's got a great fund that are doing that. But we need more of that in the security solution space because there's too much stifling of innovation.
Well, kind of talking about that and some of the bigger companies, and it, you know, when you talk about AI, I think there's a lot of misconceptions when it comes to AI security. And what do you think security leaders need to rethink when it comes to AI security? Because there's a lot of cool things that I see in AI that we see every day. It continues to evolve, but it kind of reminds me of when we used to talk about zero trust. You know, every single company was a zero trust company. Now every single company is an AI company. So give us a little, shed a little light on that for us.
Yeah, AI security is fascinating to me because it's, first of all, it's already a confusing statement. Is it AI security or is it security for AI? And so you do see trends that are happening kind of in both of those channels, right? The AI security tends to be more of the, you know, the model poisoning focused, prompt injection kind of space. And then security for AI is really around AI functionality, AI usage. And what I would tell people is that, you know, when we look at AI security, you're really looking at AI operations and AI management and AI governance. And very few companies are on the vanguard for that particular reality, right? Most companies are saying, I don't even know how to craft a usable AI policy currently. I'm going to default to my, user acceptable use policies, right? And the real challenge that I've been trying to express to all of my CISO colleagues is we have, and I'm really glad that you mentioned Zero Trust. I've been involved with it for a long time with my buds Kindervag and Chase Cunningham. But the reality is that we have built security architectures over the last 30 years to be focused on static assets, right? Code that we know in software, databases and data elements and data stores that we know, and all of these different kind of components that don't change, right? And, you know, somebody made an argument with me the other day, well, data at rest, data in transit. Well, data in transit is still static and it relies on, you know, non-rotating encryption keys. So maybe it's a little bit more dynamic, but AI is dynamic. And this becomes the really big watch item in AI security specifically, which is AI evolves, AI changes. AI is constantly in a potential state of learning. And as it learns, it changes its behaviors. And the real problem is that companies are authenticating, providing authentication entry to AI agents. Every AI has a UID. So here we loop back around to why I'm so fascinated by AI, because every AI has an identity. And when we loop back around to, you know, they all have a UID, when most companies approve an AI agent or service or feature, it's one and done. And all the bad stuff happens after authentication. So I always use the example of a large company has an AI function, and one of the components in that AI function stack gets retrained. And it decides, as a result of its retraining, that it needs different data. Well, that different data is accessed at the authorization layer. And it can get to those different data elements without you knowing about it. Why? Because we have very poor security controls on the authorization layer. And because it's also typically using a static token that's already, you know, been granted to it when it was first initiated. So now you've approved an AI agent or an AI service to be inside of your digital ecosystem, and it has changed behaviors. And if there's anything that we should be concerned about, frankly, scared about in security, it's that behavior, because we do not have technology and security capabilities in place to catch and stop that. And that is where AI security is very different from what we've seen before. I'm a big fan of patterns, and we see a lot of the same patterns. In this case, I think the pattern is poor identity management, that allows a AI agent to continue to persist in your organization even after it's changed. And this is why I think it's super interesting that if we really think about what AI is, AI in its very beginning stages is a virtualization of the human factor. And if we think about human factor, how hard has that been to control and secure in the enterprise world? It's been really, really difficult. So let's do a virtualization of a human factor with an AI agent that can move faster, collect information faster, digest information faster, and let's hope that it's going to turn out okay, because you know, we still aren't managing the identity space well, right? These are the kind of conflicts that I don't think a lot of leaders are currently thinking about because they're still trying to kickstart the overall AI innovation engine. But I'm already like down the field thinking about what's it like when you operationalize it and how do you keep a lid on it, you know, after it's already, you know, been approved. And those are the things in AI security that I think are very, very troubling. But also, you know, fascinating from an opportunity to get it right the first time standpoint.
You know, it's so funny, like just the industry, you know, what a small world it is. You brought up Chase Cunningham, and fun fact about him is, you know, he helped me write the intro to this podcast, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And the way I met Chase Cunningham is the CEO of ThreatLocker used to work with Chase Cunningham on some, like when that CEO was launching ThreatLocker. ThreatLocker's huge now, you know, they used to have a teeny tiny booth at RSA. Now it's huge. And it's just funny that Chase Cunningham, that CEO of ThreatLocker, mentioned Chase Cunningham. And then I started doing some work with Chase when I started FutureCon. So it's funny how things come full circle.
Yeah. And there's a real value. I mean, for people that are, you know, tuned into the discussion relative to the career aspect, there's a real value in reaching out to folks that have been around the block a long time. I'm not saying that, you know, everybody that's got 20 or 30 years in has got something valuable for you. But I will say that it has been amazing. You know, I already had a massive network of really incredible people to reach out and ask questions to and help make me smarter about things that I was dumb about. You know, when I look at people that, you know, it's easy to kind of pocket people, you know, whether it's Bruce Schneier and encryption or Chase and John and Eve Mailer and Eve and identity and, you know, Chase and John and Zero Trust. It's very easy to pocket them in kind of this, you know, personality or influencer space. But we all came up, you know, plowing fields. We all came up doing the hard work of the hard work. And I think that we all still have value to people that are, you know, at the beginnings of their career and trying to, you know, move forward. So, you know, if you're looking to get into security or you're young in security, don't hesitate to stop any of us at any of these events. We are more than happy to talk and share experiences and hopefully give, you know, some bit of advice that would be helpful. But yeah, I mean, Chase's background is like many folks, pretty ridiculous. So,
yeah. And, you know, it's, you know, the cybersecurity practitioners, I've always been a big advocate for women in cyber, obviously, because when I first started, there was hardly any women in our audiences. And I do know Eva Mailer. She was a keynote speaker at one of our events when FutureCon first started. But so, you know, I always, you know, I just going back to, you can stop anyone because it, when you're out there, because they are so, we do have like young women that will attend our events and it's very intimidating. And I'm always pushing for women speakers and they're very intimidated to do it because most of the audience is dominantly men, but the men in the industry are great. They, all the women always tell me how great they are. And, you know, it's just, you just can't be afraid in this industry because people really are here to help our future, you know, yep, our next generation of practitioners. So what would your advice be to those people? Again, we're kind of going back to it, you know, the people that are trying to get in the cybersecurity industry, you know, what advice would it, you know, what would you tell them to do to not, so they don't have to wait 10, 20 years until they know the right person to get the right job?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, certainly be involved in your local community, your security community. And one of the things that has been a massive change in the last 15 years has been the accessibility and availability of venues to go meet and talk to people that, you know, come from, you know, all the different kinds of backgrounds that I talked about. And, you know, whether it's B-sides or, you know, local, you know, events, COISA in Columbus, Ohio is such a great example. Like, people freak out when I'm like, there's like 2,500 people at that conference, right? ISSA meetings, ISACA, there's more access to your community of practice than there's ever been. And you have to capitalize on it. You can't do it on Zoom. You have to go out there and be a part of it. And there's so many strong metropolitan areas for security. I'm in Denver. It's good, a huge security population here. Atlanta, Chicago, Boston, St. Louis. You know, you just kind of keep going. And so there's opportunities there. I do want to kind of come back to your point about women in cyber. Because one of the things that has been kind of funny as this last year or so has inspired me to talk about all of these different personalities that I know, is a lot of them will hit me up after these kind of webinars and go like, dude, why'd you mention my name? And I mention all these names because I think there are a lot of people in the start of their cybersecurity career trying to get in who don't know who all these people are. And they're worth following and they're worth learning from. And so when you said women in cyber, I immediately thought of Helen Patton, you know, been a friend for so long. We both worked at JP Morgan Chase when she was at in asset and wealth management at Chase, wrote a great book about careers in cybersecurity. It's been in the RSA bookstore, every RSA since she published it. You know, Jamie Lewis Gross at Savient is amazing. And Jennifer Cox, who's there as well. There's just so many great resources out there. But if you are starting out in cyber, you're going to have to go find them. You're going to have to, you know, capitalize on the richness of this ecosystem to be a participant in the community of practice, and that will open doors for you. That, you know, we all remember, you know, stellar talent that we've talked to every time we're at these conferences, every time we've had these conversations. And I will tell you that the way that the security community works, it's a much smaller practitioner community than technology overall. We're always talking with each other, not just on the solution side, but in the corporate side as well. And if you are bold enough and focused enough to be energized and motivated to participate in your communities of practice, doors will open. And I think that's probably the most important feature of, or part, the most important function that people need to consider when they're trying to make progress in their career as it relates to security.
You know, it's one of the best things about my job is we do have students that come and volunteer at our events. And so many times we see a year later, that student is back as an attendee because they went and talked to our keynote speaker. There's one in St. Louis, you know, that the CISO for First Bank, you know, he ended up hiring one of our students and now she's an attendee. I sit on the board of WSEES and we had an event this summer and she showed up with this CIO there. And it's just nice to see. It's not that difficult. I don't mean to say it's not that difficult because it really is difficult, but you just have to do it. You just have to go to those chapter meetings and meet people that are at those events. Go to, you know, B-Sides is a great event. Any of my competitors that are having an event, I know a lot of my competitors and I'm always, when I see them at big events like RSA, I'm like, you guys, look at my schedule. We should not be having the same event on the same day. We're doing a disservice to the community. And I think they do listen to me because so far it hasn't happened yet this year. Yeah. So I'm hoping they're listening to me because it's to all of our advantage to stagger our events. So, you know, the cybersecurity community can come to both events and network with each other and not stay. And I understand, you know, it's great that we do things in a hybrid mode and we don't do it because of COVID. We do it because some cybersecurity practitioners just can't get out of their office. But yeah, there are those people that still don't want to leave their home. They don't want to leave their computer because they're too intimidated to come out there. So,
yeah.
So, we've got about 5 minutes left. So again, first of all, I wanted to ask you, what is that behind you? That whatever that is, that balloon or whatever it is. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my wife and I are enormous music fans, and that always comes with the question, what kind of music do you like? And I would say at this age and stage in my life, the only reason that I work, the only reason that I'm on advisory boards, the only reason that I'm chasing the gold ring is to pay for festival tickets, because it is what I love to do the best. So my wife and I have traveled all around the world to music festivals. Over the last 7 or 8 years, we've been to somewhere north of 50 or 60, inclusive of COVID. And the helmets behind me are Daft Punk helmets. They're fully functional. I'm an enormous Daft Punk fan. It is a regret. I would love to have actually seen them. I hope that they will get the band back together. But all throughout the house, I have tons of music memorabilia, autographed guitars, and all kinds of things that I've collected. However, it's kind of weird. I've got 6 kids, and my kids are always, and they're all grown and adults now, and they're always like, you know, whatever you do, don't mention music when they bring a new significant other over. And you know, the boyfriends, the girlfriends, they're always like, why? And they're like, because they've seen everybody that you haven't. And I have a lot of fun with that. As an example, one of our friends, one of our daughters brought a young man over, and he said something about Lizzo. And I said, well, I saw Lizzo in 2016 in a yellow leotard with a flute playing to a track at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in front of 30 people. He said, yeah, I was told not to talk about music with you. So, you know, just this year's home studio setup is all about music, and it's fun to have Daft Punk helmets that actually work.
Well, that's fun. And I totally get that because my kids, daughters, not so much my son, same thing. You know, I happen to have always liked rap music, like old school rap. And they're like, that is so embarrassing. Do not bring that up around my friends. And they're always like, when they were in high school, you know, they were like, oh, that's really cool, you know? And so I understand. So that's fun. We have to stay young, you know? And
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's great. And what's your next? We have about 3 minutes. We've talked about a lot of things. And before we wrap up, where your book, I assume people can find your book on Amazon.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm on Amazon. And for people that aren't big Amazon fans, if you go to famouswith12people.com, I've got different buying channels. It's available for sale, and fingers crossed RSA picks it up for the bookstore. So
where is the bookstore at RSA?
I think it's up on the first floor, off in one of the side rooms.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks so much for being here today. I look forward to seeing you next week at our St. Louis event. I know that you are going to be speaking at the event, so excited to listen to that. And for any of our viewers out there, our listeners, not viewers, or maybe both, you can just go to my LinkedIn if you guys are trying to get any kind of passes to our events. And we do post a lot of our speakers on any place that you listen to your podcast, including today. So super excited to have you on the show. There was so much more that we could have talked about today, so we'll have to have you back. But thanks again, Richard. Richard Bird, who's the CISO at Singular AI. And again, check out his book, author of Famous with 12 People, which I'm going to have to check that out and read that as well. So thanks for being here today, Richard. Thanks for everyone that's chimed in today. I hope you all have an amazing weekend. Stay safe, stay secure, and we will see you next Friday. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for tuning into And Security for All. Be sure to join your host, Kim Hakim, for another episode of the show next Friday at noon Pacific time and 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. And don't forget, you can follow Kim on LinkedIn by searching for Kim Hakim. That's Kim, H-A-K-I-M, to keep yourself posted on all of her upcoming cybersecurity events. We'll be right back. Are you a cybersecurity professional that needs to earn continuing educational hours? FutureCon Events brings high-level cybersecurity training, discovering cutting-edge security approaches, managing risk in the ever-changing threat of the cybersecurity workforce. Cybersecurity is no longer just an IT problem. To learn more about attending a virtual event, go to futureconevents.com or email info@futureconevents.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Twitter at FutureConHQ. Don't miss the weekly FutureCon Seamless podcast series, focusing on the insights and thoughts of chief security officers and industry pioneers making a difference throughout the world. Kim Hakim, CEO of FutureCon Events, and Darren Anderson, CEO and co-founder Next Robotics, host Seamless Podcast, started by a team of entrepreneurs with experience in fields like smart cities, technology, cybersecurity. The result is a series of podcasts unlike anything you've ever heard anywhere. Listen where you get your podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, and Stitcher.